We are continuing our journey through the life of Jesus, and we've been doing this for a while. We're over halfway through. We have a lot of this year, a lot of ground to cover still. Today, we're going to see a familiar encounter and a familiar response. And when I say that, let me tell you what it is right up front. This will be two stories today, where Jesus heals somebody on the Sabbath day, and then afterwards he takes criticism or critique for doing so. Now, if that sounds familiar to you, it's because it's happened a lot. Actually, today's two new stories, we're going to have a review story in the middle, but today's two new stories are going to be time number 6 and time number 7, where Jesus heals someone on the Sabbath day. And in every one of those cases, minus one, he got criticized for doing so. And there's another story, not on a healing, where he also got flack for Sabbath day rules. And you say, well, Arlen, if we're going to see it again, and we've seen stories like this before in this series, why not just skip these ones? And I thought about it. I'll be honest. I thought about not covering these last two Sabbath healing stories because we have been there before. But before I do, I'm going to tell you why we didn't. Because if this issue keeps coming up over and over again, maybe there's a reason. And here's the reason. In Jesus' day, the Sabbath day stuff was a hot button issue in the religious culture. It's not to you, it's not to me today, so we want to glaze over it, but it was a hot button issue in his day, and there's lessons to be drawn from how he navigated that and how religious people are supposed to navigate their issues that I think we can draw from today, 2,000 years later. So let's jump in. The first story is in Luke 13. The second will be in Luke 14. Luke 13, verse 10 says, one Sabbath day, as Jesus was teaching in a synagogue, just a real quick side note, synagogues were everywhere where there were Jewish people. They would build synagogues, and different people in the congregation could take turns reading if they had reading days, but the teachers would be specially approved people or out-of-town guests, and whenever Jesus came into town, they almost always had him speak at synagogues, even though many of the rulers of the synagogue were not followers of Jesus, and some of the leading Pharisees did not always like or agree with him. They would have him because whenever a rabbi or an influential person would come, they would usually give them that honor. And when Jesus went somewhere, guess what Jesus brought with him? He brought a crowd. And so they knew that if they had him speak at the synagogue, the place would be packed, so they would have him come speak at the synagogues whenever he was around. And one Sabbath day, he's teaching in a synagogue, and it says he saw a woman who had been crippled by an evil spirit. She had been bent double for 18 years and was unable to stand up straight. Seems like a spiritual and a physical affliction combined here. I don't fully understand it. I researched modern understandings of this ailment, and I got some really wild name that I tried to pronounce. I actually looked at the pronunciation 7 times, and I still have forgotten it again. But I think it's this one ailment that I can't explain. Although in our earlier service, Cliff and Carolyn are running our online functions right now for those watching online, and their daughter has a certain kind of other spinal issue that she gave me another long name for, I don't remember, that could be similar to this. So these are afflictions that people have had, but this lady was bent double. She was bent double for 18 years, it says. She can't say she has to walk around and operate. Have you ever met somebody who's that hunched over? And what a terrible way to live for so long. It says in verse 12, when Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, dear woman, you are healed of your sickness. I don't know if he was in the middle of teaching or if he was finished or just starting, but he just stops and says, come here. By the way, I want to commend her for a moment. She showed up. I don't know if she attended that synagogue every week. That was a part of her religious practice. Or I don't know if maybe she actually just came that one day because Jesus was in town and she wanted to hear him. Or maybe she came to be healed. She never asks to be healed, but maybe she hoped. Either way, Jesus can't help himself as he always does. He just sees a problem and says, let me fix that. So he heals her. Verse 13 says, then he touched her, and instantly she could stand straight. By the way, that's a miracle in itself, as we've seen with other healings. Because not only did he fix the problem that had her bent double, but all the other ligaments and muscles that had atrophy from not being used a certain way are all restored. and she's able to stand up straight. It's a total, total miracle. And it says how she praised God. And I love that wording. Luke is like, I don't know how else to explain it. She was so excited that I'll just write it this way. How she praised God. I mean, her life was transformed in a moment. Everyone's happy. Well, not everyone's happy. Look at verse 14. But the leader in charge of the synagogue was indignant that Jesus had healed her on the Sabbath day. He's not happy that she's healed. He's not excited that she's restored. Is she one of the regular attenders there, or is she a visitor? Either way, he's not thrilled for her miracle. His emotion is singular, anger. He is indignant that Jesus had the audacity to heal this woman on the Sabbath day, because to him, it wasn't about the woman getting healed, it was about the issue, and the Sabbath day is a biblical, spiritual issue, and we must take it seriously. And he is so upset at Jesus. It says in the next verse, here's what he says to them. There are 6 days for working, he said to the crowd. Come on those days to be healed, not on the Sabbath. Now, interesting, he says it to the crowd. Jesus did the healing, but he won't address Jesus. He addresses the crowd. You've met people like that. Maybe we are people like that. You can't say what you want to the person you're mad at because you're afraid, so you take it out on somebody else. He's mad at what Jesus did, so he chews out the crowd because he's the ruler of the synagogue. He doesn't want to mess with Jesus directly. So his answer is, there are 6 days of the week for working. Well, who's working? This lady didn't work. She showed up. Everyone else showed up too. That's not work, is it? If that's work, we've all failed. But he's mad at Jesus for healing her. What he's basically saying is, don't show up and tempt this guy who can't help himself. You're making him work. Come on a different day. Now here's the crazy part. How long had she been in that condition? Remember? Not a trick question, 18 years. 18 years she'd been in that condition. You know how many months that is? That is 216 months. Or that is 936 weeks. If you're gonna get really granular for a minute here, that's 6,570 days of getting up in the morning and being in that condition all day long, of going to bed that night in that condition for 6,570 days of her life. And the synagogue leader says, come back tomorrow. Come back tomorrow. Right? It's crazy, isn't it? But again, what's more important to him than her is this doctrinal issue of the Sabbath day. So come back tomorrow. And Jesus, it has none of it. Verse 15 says, but the Lord replied, you hypocrites. Now, why does he say hypocrites in the plural? It's because we're going to see this in the next story as well. Whenever there was a religious leader who would speak up like this against Jesus, there was always people around in the synagogue in this case who agreed with him. When he said that, when he scolded the audience for letting that happen, they probably clapped or said amen or hear, hear, or hello, or something weird like that. Who knows? But anyhow, they were in the audience, agreeing that should not have happened for that woman. And Jesus says, you hypocrites. He says, each of you works on the Sabbath day. That's why they're hypocrites, by the way. He says, each of you works on the Sabbath day. Don't you untie your ox or your donkey from its stall on the Sabbath and lead it out for water? He's calling out the hypocrisy, but the funny part to me is, basically, Jesus just said, it takes as much effort for me to heal a woman of an 18-year disease as it takes for you to untie your ox and donkey and lead it to water. Talk about the power of God right there. He's like, yeah, it's the equivalent right there, right? He said, but here's the deal. You do work too. You just do work that matters to you, so you're hypocrites. And we're going to see that word come back to remind us later, because usually that's what happens. What most of us get in trouble with when it comes to our beliefs, it's not that we have beliefs, that's fine. It's when we start holding those beliefs against other people, and it always exposes in all of us hypocrisy. It just always does. Because when it comes down to the scriptures, everyone here picks and chooses. Not that we should, but we do. So when we start throwing someone else under the bus, it exposes a hypocrisy. Jesus says in verse 16, this dear woman, a daughter of Abraham, has been held in bondage by Satan for 18 years. Isn't it right that she be released even on the Sabbath? And this, it says in verse number 17, that this shamed his enemies, but all the people rejoiced at the wonderful things he did. The people are happy that she was healed. The people are happy that he probably scolded the religious fuddy-duddies, but the people who he was calling out felt shame. Not that they were changed, but they felt shame probably because, well, he exposed them. He exposed the hypocrisy. We have one more story today to tell that's new. But before, I'm going to take several minutes here. I'm going to take a little time to remind you of a story that we saw last year. And the reason I'm going to review that story is because it really plays into the big point of today's message. We're not going to turn there because we spent time there before. But if you want to know, it's in Mark chapter 2. We were there months and months ago. Let me just review it with you for a few minutes, okay? Because it speaks to this subject. The story I'm going to review is where Jesus was one day walking along the road on the Sabbath day with his disciples, and a whole bunch of religious leaders were following him. Why? Because they were Jesus followers? No. They were following him to find fault with him. That's what they were doing. You see, they knew that if they followed him enough, they could find him doing something they disagreed with, and they could make a big old deal about it to try to diminish his influence because they didn't like how he... They believed that they were doing the God thing the right way, and he was not. And they were teaching the right things, and he was not. They were doing it the right systems, and he was not. And so whenever they could find fault to diminish him, they looked for reasons. And that's not unusual. I've seen it, sadly, in today's culture, amongst the religious world, even in the Christian world, sadly, it's a sad story, where people will find a religious leader or an influencer that has a lot of influence for Christ, but they don't agree with how that leader or how that influencer or how that whoever, how they teach or how they run that church, or how they teach, or how they influence, or who they hang with. And so they will take sound bites from those people and say, listen to nothing they teach, but here's a few things that we can pull together and say, aren't they terrible? They're bad, to diminish their influence because we don't like the people that we feel don't fall into the line. Whereas religious people have never changed. There's a lot of amazing ones, and there's a lot of difficult ones. And here's the people who were in power and they did not like Jesus because they got to find the things to find fault with to diminish him. Because God forbid that someone just does a different thing than I would do and makes an impact for the kingdom. We've got to tear down his influence. So they followed him everywhere he went. The problem is that as he did this, his disciples, it's the Sabbath day, his disciples began to pick crops on the side of the road. It was harvest season. And they began to eat. And the Pharisees go crazy. The religious leaders are like, hey, they're breaking the Sabbath rules. They're breaking the scriptures. And quite honestly, they were. I want to remind you, we actually studied this a few months ago, but we went back to the Hebrew scriptures, and the scriptures were very plain. You can't even pick food off the ground to gather it on the Sabbath day. You got to do all of that the day before because the rules were so tight. They were not wrong to call the disciples by the letter of the law. And Jesus is going to stick up for them, but Jesus doesn't even pretend that they were wrong. I mean, that the Pharisees were wrong. He's like, okay. He never one time says, actually, they're not breaking the scriptural laws. His answer instead is this. So do you. So did your King David that you used to admire when he was a young man, when he ate the showbread. So do your priests every week in the temple. So do you, like we saw earlier. His answer was not, they weren't breaking that law. His answer was, and so do you. Which is an interesting response from Jesus, by the way. But anyhow, his point was this, and here's what he says next. It's so powerful. And this is why we're reviewing. Are you ready? I love this verse. I think most of you will appreciate it too. In Mark 2:27, it says, then Jesus said to them, the Sabbath was made to meet the needs of people and not people to meet the requirements of the Sabbath. That is such a big idea that it gets me all fired up. It's a passion point. The problem with this verse is that I always feel like I can't make a big enough deal out of it. I'll talk to somebody else, like, isn't that great? Uh-huh. Oh. So here's the deal. Let's just think about what he said here. He said I'll read it again. The Sabbath was made in order to meet the needs of people. People were not made to meet the requirements of the Sabbath. So let me just, here's what Jesus was saying. God wasn't in heaven one day saying, you know what I really love? I love a good system. I like order and structure, just a good system. And so I'm going to create something that's really systematic and beautiful. And, you know, he's not up there saying, I got to make these rules, and then I got to make some kind of creatures to follow my little fancy system. And so they go in this way, they come out that way, and it goes a certain way. Maybe I'll make people, I'll make them robots, puppets on a string. No, I'll give them free will. But if they break my system, I will crush them. Because they must honor my system, because I love my little system. He's giggling up there. And hey, keep the system. Show me you know your place. I think there are people who think that's how God operates. Jesus, that's not how he didn't sit there and say, you know what, I got some great ideas, and I just need some minions to make it magically work the way I like it to. He did the opposite. He made people. People were the point. People first. He's what he said. He said, the Sabbath was made in order to meet the needs of people. All of God's laws are given to help us, to make the world a better place, to serve mankind, to help us. The Sabbath is a good example. When the Israelites were coming out of slavery in Egypt, they had lived a slave's life. He's trying to establish a nation for them, laws to live by. And here's what he says. He says, I want one of your policies, it's one of the top 10, don't work one day a week. Because for much of human history, people can grind 7 days a week all day to survive. And he's like, you've got to take some time to rest. And it's amazing to me how that in recent decades, by the way, 3,500 years after that law was given, to the newly freed slaves from Egypt, who God would tell the stories of creation to say, God made things in 6 days, rested on the seventh, do the same, rest one day a week. And it's interesting that 3,500 years later, here we are. And studies have shown us over and over again that people actually are more productive when they have intentional regular time off. That people who work 6 days out of seven are more productive in the long run than people who work 7 out of 7. It makes no mathematical sense, right? It seems like if you worked 86% of the possible hours, you would not be as productive as if you worked 100% of the possible hours. And yet, we perform better when we have intentional periods of rest and recovery. We need rest and recovery. And all those many years ago, he says, here's the law. Don't work. And he was picky. He's like, don't pick things up even to gather. Don't gather any food of any kind. Everything's got to be done ahead of time. In your house, settle down. Don't do any gathering. Don't work in your fields. Why did he have to be that particular in making that law for this new nation? Well, let's just think about that. If he would have just said something like, hey guys, here's a really good idea. Take a day off every week. How many people would have said, okay, thanks, and not done it? And just kept working themselves into the ground. If he would have just said, take a day off with no nuance, you know what some of us would have done who are workaholics? You'd be like, well, I'm going to work a half a day in the field on this extra day because I don't want to work a full day because we're supposed to take it a little easier. The only way to get them to take a day off as a serious issue is to say, here's how elaborate I'm talking about so that you will rest. Because the Sabbath was made to help meet the needs of the people who needed the recovery. He did not make people to follow another one of his rules so they know their place. Now that might seem like a subtle statement to you, but that idea divides us into one of two major schools of thought of how we approach our beliefs and how we impose them on other people. Why are the laws there? Why are the scriptures there? And again, I want to say this to you. This is so big before I go any further. That the people who Jesus is wrestling with are not villains. We read the story 2,000 years ago, and these religious people and Pharisees are villains. Can I remind you who the Pharisees were? They were the church attending, or can I say synagogue attending, because what they went to, church attending, scripture reading, scripture memorizing people who cared about what God said, who cared about doctrinal correctness, who cared about theological purity. Many of us today, if we were alive back then, I know that we don't care about the Sabbath rules now as much. Probably not as much as we should, really. But here's the deal. It's not our issue today. But if we were alive 2,000 years ago, many of us who are church-going, Bible reading, scripture memorizing, you know, doctrinal purity, you know, correctness people, we would be having the same hang-up. And Jesus is looking at them and saying, you've missed the whole point of why God did what he did. And what he was telling them is this, that people are the point. People are the point. And what happens to us then and today is you get so caught up in getting it right that you can make your issues to be more important than the individuals. But issues should never be more important than individuals. That's not why God made the laws in the first place. Today, we just have different issues, but how many times do we fight about them and over them more than the individuals who are getting trampled? The fact that guys were picking food on the Sabbath day was like, okay, well, they're hungry. But the law was made to help them, not to beat them down. You're missing the point. People are the point. If we can get that idea, it would change how we do everything. But anyhow, let's keep going. I got one more story to tell, and that was my detour. Luke 14, verse 1. One Sabbath day, Jesus went to eat in the home of a leader of the Pharisees, and all the people were watching him closely. Okay, I need one more detour. Sorry, can't help myself. This is a passion point for me. Did you notice that Jesus is eating in the house of religious leaders here? They didn't even like him. Most of them didn't even like the guy, but he would eat with them. Now, usually they were there, they had him over to scrutinize them. You're like, well, why would they have him over if they didn't like him? The same reason they'd have him preach in their synagogues, because he would bring the crowd. Because having them in their house would be like, I had Jesus in our house. Oh, did you? Yes. And so they could have, it's a who's who thing, but also a chance to get deeper and to find fault. The same reason they followed him around as he walked through the fields. And so he's in this house, but here's the cool part. Jesus is willing to eat with the religious nut jobs, and he was willing to eat with the crowd that they wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. Someone tell me a story we heard in the last year of somebody that would be on the opposite end of the religious people, and Jesus ate at their house. Does anybody remember a story we've seen? Zacchaeus is coming. Okay, I want to give you a hint. Zacchaeus works in the same field, industry, as the person I'm thinking of. Matthew. Jesus went to Matthew's house, a tax collector, and Matthew had a bunch of people over, and you know what? These are not my words. These are Bible words, okay? He ate with a bunch of people and hung out with people who were, quote, disreputable sinners, unquote. I don't know what that means. Sounds ominous. Disreputable sinners. And Jesus is eating with them, and guess what? He ate with that side of the tracks, and he ate with the religious side of the tracks. Because he would go to anybody. You know why? Because Jesus came to save everyone. People were lost in different ways. They were either lost in obviously bad, sinful choices that will harm themselves and others, or they may have been lost in religion and self-righteousness. And you could be just as lost in religion and self-righteousness as you can be in anything else. And Jesus wants to save everybody. But here's the cool part. Here's the sad part. Whenever he ate with the disreputable sinners, the religious crowd would throw a fit. You'll never see the disreputable sinners protesting outside the doors when he ate with the religious people. They didn't care. They figured he probably did that. The only scrutiny he would get for eating with the religious people is the other religious people at the table who don't like what he was doing. But when he would eat with the disreputable sinners, the religious crowd would throw a fit. And that's why. And nothing's changed. Guarantee you, you ever try to do something for the Lord, try to serve the Lord, okay, you could be in your local church as a church, or as an individual, as a leader of a church, as an elder or a deacon in a church, as a vocal Christian in your workplace, as an influencer, do something for the kingdom of God and watch what will happen to you. As long as you cater to the religious people, you'll have bickering amongst them about how to do it right. But you ever cross over to areas they don't think you should do with those people and help that group and be with those, they'll crucify you. And what happens is people are discouraged to ever step into that space, but Jesus didn't care. Why does it happen? I don't know. It happens because the squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? Like I've often said in a church world before, No one in the community that needs the Lord is going to call the church next week and complain that the songs were too loud or the songs were too quiet or the words weren't doctrinal enough or the translation wasn't right. Those are the things you get from the inside. And so our focus is always pulled to focus on the inside and to fight to say, how can we bring life and good news to people who need the hope of Jesus? Well, that will get you criticized from a lot of religious people too. But Jesus didn't care. He's like, I'm going to do it anyhow. And if we had more brave people who are willing to take it on the chin for loving everyone and not just the certain people who we are allowed to love, wouldn't the world be a better place? That's our job, to bring the truth of Jesus everywhere. So Jesus was eating with anybody, but now he's eating with a Pharisee, so that's okay. And he's at their house, and it says the people are watching him closely. Why are they watching him closely? Well, it's because it was a setup. Look at the next verse. It says, there was a man there whose arms and legs were swollen. Now, I'm pretty sure knowing this crowd, they didn't care about this guy. He probably wasn't part of their group, but they needed a prop. They needed somebody in the room to tempt Jesus. So they brought a guy in. It's almost like a movie where the bad guy, you ever watch a movie and the bad guy's like, how do I trap the hero? I know, I'll put someone in he cares about in trouble so he'll come to rescue them. They're like, Jesus can't help himself. He's going to heal somebody. We'll put him in the room. He'll heal him because he can't stop himself. And then we're going to really be able to condemn him because it's the Sabbath day. So this guy is in the room. His arms and legs are swollen. Now, in my old Bible, when I grew up, the King James, it says that he had the dropsy. I don't know why it said this. I grew up wondering, what did this man have? He had the dropsy. What is that? I figure as I get older, I have the dropsies way more than I used to. So maybe I'm getting that disease. I don't know. How many of you have the dropsies in here today? Okay, some testimonies. All right. Anyhow, that apparently the Greek word, it refers to water. This man was swollen in his arms and legs. And they had him in the house to see what Jesus would do. And Jesus knows what is going to go down. This is not his first rodeo. And so, in verse number 3, it says, Jesus asked the Pharisees and the experts in religious law, hey, is it permitted in the law to heal people on the Sabbath day or not? So here's what he's doing. He's like, listen, let me just call out the elephant in the room. Not that the man with swollen legs and arms was an elephant. That's not what I meant. He's just like, listen, let's just address the tension before I do anything. Let's just talk about it. Is it okay to heal them or not? What do you guys think? Verse 4 says this, when they refused to answer, Jesus touched the sick man and healed him and sent him away. He just sends him home. Now, it's interesting that they refused to answer. They refused to answer because they did not want to come to a conclusion. Don't miss this now. They're sitting there with their arms crossed. Their minds were already made up, and they did not want to have a conversation. Because a conversation might get some progress. It might come to an understanding. So, nope, my mind's made up. My line is drawn. What are you going to do? And Jesus is like, whatever. He just heals the man and sends him away, which is the nicest thing he could have done. Hey, you're healed, be happy. You get to leave here, be happy. And he just sends the guy away. And then look what Jesus says in verse 4. Verse 5, then he turned to the people, the people in the room, and he said, which of you doesn't work on the Sabbath? This is the same thing he said earlier when he called them hypocrites. He's calling them hypocrites again. He says, you are hypocrites because you work on the Sabbath also. He says, if your son or your cow falls into a pit, don't you rush to get him out? He said, come on, guys, every one of you does this. Again, it's work. He's not even questioning the strictness of the Sabbath laws. He's just saying everyone does it. He says, picture this. He says, your son falls into a pit and you run over there, son, are you okay? And he's like, dad, help. I've fallen and I can't get up. And then you're like, oh, bummer, son. But you know what? There's 18 more hours in the Sabbath day, so I can't really help you. But you hang in there, buddy. Dad, can I have some water at least to get me through in case I dehydrate? Son, that'd be work. But listen, I'll come back tomorrow. Don't you go dying on me now. Right? No. You're going to reach out. You're going to get him out of that pit. If your cow falls into a pit, you know why you're going to get your cow out? Because your cow is your means of production. Your cow is your means of financial well-being. You will protect your investments even on the Sabbath day. But some guy who's not your problem with swollen arms and legs or some woman who bent double, who cares? because we don't do that on the Sabbath day. He says, you're hypocrites. Verse 6, again, they could not answer. Those are the stories. Arlen, we've seen so many stories where Jesus has healed someone on the Sabbath day. Same dance. Why? Again, it's recorded repeatedly because in those days it was a hot button topic. It's not a hot button topic because all of us are team Jesus. And if Jesus says doesn't matter, then it doesn't matter to us either. But it mattered to the people who cared about what was right back then. It was their issue. I always wonder, what's our hot button topics today? Where again, the scriptures say, okay, doctrinal correctness, okay, theological purity, and the issues to us are so passionate that we don't even see how, as we circle around them, we mistreat the individuals, people who are on the wrong side of our issue. And we don't even think about it. In fact, here's what I think I've seen this, sadly, is someone gets trampled over our issues and we're like, well, I don't know, I didn't mean to. So it's okay if I didn't mean to. I trampled them, it doesn't matter, I didn't mean to, so it's okay. And they should have not been on the wrong side of my issue. That's their fault. And Jesus has this come up over and over again to teach something that I think we need to get a hold of today. And we've kind of beat this drum already. But let me just say it this way today. And this piece of advice, I'm going to put it on the screen. I think it would change everything. Maybe I'm just too idealistic. I think that if we followed what we're about to say, it would make everything better. It goes like this. Hold yourself, not others, to the standard of your beliefs and convictions. Hold yourself, not others, to the standards of your beliefs and convictions. I'm not saying don't have beliefs and convictions. Everybody in the world has beliefs and convictions. People who are Jesus followers, who worship in a different Christian practice than you do, different denomination than you do, they have beliefs and standards just like you do. People on the opposite side of your political aisle, whichever side you're on, have beliefs and convictions. Yes, they do, the wrong ones, okay? But everyone has beliefs and convictions. People with different moral codes than you do, they believe in things and they have convictions. They just don't share the ones that you think are important. In fact, here's what I'm saying. We ought to have beliefs and convictions, and we ought to live up to them. We ought to strive to hold ourselves to that standard. If I believe something, I ought to live by it. But why are we holding others to the standard of our beliefs and convictions? Now here, I see this all the time. I see Christians sometimes do this. They'll be like, the world today, people in the world, they don't practice, the Bible says this, they're not following the Bible. And I'm always like, why would they? It's not their book. They don't follow my code. Why would they? It's not their code. Well, it should be. Okay, great. But if it isn't, why are you surprised that people who don't believe what you believe don't do what you do? And why are you surprised that people who don't claim to follow what you follow don't follow what you follow? And people get so mad and they're throwing, we rant and rave because people aren't doing what my book says. And you know what happens inevitably? When people feel criticized by folks who call themselves Christians for that, inevitably they're like, first of all, you're a jerk. And second of all, they're like, you don't even follow it, which is what Jesus was saying all day today. I'll take your own stuff against you and show you that you've been picking and choosing yourself. So here's the best advice I could give us. Hold yourself, not others, to the standard of your beliefs and convictions. Even within your faith community, you're like, well, these people share my faith, but they sit in the church with me and they don't do family or this the way I would. So? If I believe something, I should follow it. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to confess to you. You don't have to raise your hand because I don't think everyone wants to do that. But I'm going to confess to you. I have beliefs and convictions and I don't measure up to them. There's things that I believe and I feel are important in my life and I don't always get it right. I want to be a better person. I want to be a perfect husband. I want to be a perfect dad. I want to be a perfect son. I want to be a perfect, you know, citizen, human. I want to have the right thoughts. I want to have the right temperament and not ever be angry. I want to do everything right. I have a lot of things I believe in that I don't measure up to. And neither do you, but no one's, you know what? That's okay. Because everyone respects you when you have things you believe in and you aim for them even though you come short. They're like, well, at least you believe something and you're aiming to be the best person you can be. That's admirable. What's not admirable is when we use those things to attack others. Say, but people shouldn't do that. Arlen, I don't think that behavior is right. And you know what my answer always is? Okay, then don't do it. If you don't think it's right, then don't do it. Well, I know it's not right. Good, then if you know it's not right, then don't do it. Well, I think that people should do this. Good, then do that. We should hold ourselves to the standard of our beliefs and convictions. Now, here's the problem. And you say, well, what if you have authority? That's, you know, for example, if you have a company, you have a right to say in my company that where you have a sphere of influence, this is how we do things here. When you're raising kids, same thing. But as outside of your direct area of authority, you can sit there and say, look, I got to hold myself to the standard of my beliefs and convictions. I can't control outside that box. You know how much better the world would be? Because I'm going to tell you, there's two sides of Christianity and culture. One that is loved, it's loved, and one that is hated. And it's not Christianity's fault. It's the way people who call themselves Christians behave. But one side is loved, one side is hated. Let's start with the good side and I'll be done. Here's the good side. People who truly live by the teachings of Jesus, who embrace his work, his truth, his message, who let it shape our values, our character, our work ethic, our relationships. People who are like that, they're a bright light in a dark world sometimes. They're salt of the earth. There's a lot of people in the world who see Christians like that, and they're like, you know what? I don't believe what they believe, but I respect them. There are people in the world today who would say, and you know this, they'd say, I don't share their faith system, but I want to hire them to work for me because they're the best workers I ever have. There are people in the world today who say, I don't share your beliefs, but I want those kind of people to marry my children because they'll be taken care of well, they'll be treated well. Because that's what Christianity brings out of us if we follow Jesus, is it brings a better person because we not only just believe something, we follow him. We follow what he gives us. And I think that people can say, I don't share your views, but I want more like you around. That's the good side. Then there's the other side. And I don't know if the modern day and technology and social media has made this worse or if it's always been pretty hideous. But there's another side where people who call themselves Christians are angry and down and critical of others who aren't living up to what they believe they ought to. And telling people you're wrong because this is what I believe, so you're wrong. And making issues more important than individuals. And everyone else out there says, gross, what a jerk, how self-righteous, how arrogant, how much of a turnoff. And by the way, then our junk starts seeping out. And our sins start coming to the forefront. They're like, wow, you're not even real. So here's the best advice. It would change everything. I think it would change our whole ministry in the world. I mean, I'm a Jesus follower. I think we're supposed to be. That's the best way to live. And if we would hold ourselves and not others to the standards of our beliefs and convictions, it would be amazing. So let's believe in something. Let's practice it. Live like you believe is right, and love everyone else. If we would live right and love others, it would go a long ways. Because people are the point. Part of living right is loving others. Did you know that? Inevitably, I see the people who are like the religious people today stand on the issue of the scriptures and doctrinal correctness and theological purity and making issues cause them to mistreat individuals. Whenever I see that, I always think to myself, in today's culture, some of us who would do that would say this: I've got to defend God. I got to defend him in this world. And I'm like, first of all, God's a big boy, okay? I think he's like cowering in the corner. Please defend me. He's okay. But if you really care about God and his image, if he's the reason you do what you do, the best thing you can do for God is do what he did. Love the people he loves. God so loved the world that he gave his son. God so loved the world that he sacrificed. If we want to do something for God, if we're doing it for God, the best thing you can do for God is live the way he calls us to and love everyone around us. And if we got that figured out, if we figured out that people are the point, individuals matter more than our issues, not that our issues don't matter, but individuals matter more, and that we would hold ourselves and not others to the standard of our convictions and beliefs, I think this thing would go splendidly. And so it's a hobby horse topic for me because I fantasize that one day we'll all get this right. I want to say this about Lighthouse Church. I think we get this right here, largely. People, if you've been coming here this long and listen to my long, rambly rants about this kind of stuff, and you're like, yeah, I've watched you. I watch how you serve in the community. I watch the things you do. I watch the way we treat people. I think we get this right. But I think there's always a tendency to get sucked into a religious substitute for following Jesus. It takes us away from just living right and loving others. It takes us into self-righteousness and arrogance and judgment. We got to fight that. Let's keep it up. Let's just live like Jesus calls us to, and let's love others well.